Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of ENT in a Nutshell. My name is Patrick Kiesling, and I'll be your host. Today, we are joined again by Dr. Kara Meister, a board-certified and fellowship-trained pediatric otolaryngologist. Today, we will be discussing congenital nasolacrimal duct obstruction and cysts, otherwise known as dacryocystocele or dacryostenosis. Dr. Meister, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. This is one of my favorite diagnoses.
Oh, great. So let's get started. Today's topic covers congenital nasolacrimal duct obstruction, otherwise known sometimes as dacryostenosis, as well as congenital nasolacrimal duct cysts, otherwise sometimes known as dacryocystoceles. We've had a couple of episodes reviewing nasal masses so far, and today's topic helps augment those episodes by providing some more insight into anomalies in development and their manifestations in and around the nose. So let's get started with some background and start with nasolacrimal duct obstruction in general. Can you tell us about the nasolacrimal duct and what can cause obstruction?
To understand the nasolacrimal duct, we first need to talk about some structures in the eye. The surface of the eye is lubricated, protected, and constantly moistened with tears. So tears are good for us. They're produced by the lacrimal glands. Mostly they are comprised of salt and water. The lacrimal glands are located in the upper, outer corners of the eye, specifically the lacrimal fossa of the temporal bone. This fluid mixes with oil from your meibomian glands, located along the edges of the eyelids, as it moves across the surface of the eye. Tears then drain into the nose via the nasolacrimal duct system. First, it exits the surface of the eye through the lacrimal puncta, two for each eye, the medial aspect of the upper and lower eyelids. Then those drain into the canaliculi, which are small channels that drain the fluid through the valve of Rosemuller into the lacrimal sac. The lacrimal sac is a reservoir for the overflow of tears. This is the upper dilated end of a nasolacrimal duct. From here, tears travel via the nasolacrimal duct down to Hasler's valve, which is located just beneath the inferior turbinate on the lateral wall of the nasal cavity. We often call this the inferior meatus. Then tears drain into the nasal cavity and either off the face or down the back of the nasopharynx. I think it's important to recognize that many patients, they don't know that your tears actually drain into your nose. And so I'll tell them, yes, this is why when you cry, your nose runs. And I think establishing that can be very helpful when you're explaining these pathologies. Specifically about the nasolacrimal duct, both valves, Rosemuller and Hasner, are mucosal flaps that prevent retrograde flow of tears or, say, air when you're blowing your nose. In terms of embryologic development, the nasolacrimal apparatus starts to form really early, between weeks 3 and 5, before a lot of families even know they are expecting. A cord of epithelium begins to form, connecting the primitive eyes to the nose, and then canalization of this cord will create the nasolacrimal drainage apparatus and is usually completed by birth. Nasolacrimal duct obstruction occurs when all but one site of this apparatus is opened. The most common site of a nasolacrimal duct obstruction is at Hasner's valve, and an imperforate membrane prevents drainage of the lacrimal fluid into the nasal cavity at this level. General stenosis of the duct is the second most common cause of duct obstruction. So most commonly, the obstruction is going to be at Hasner's valve. Second most commonly, it's going to be a more generalized stenosis of the duct.
How common is nasolacrimal duct obstruction, and are there any associated risk factors for development of this?
So it's actually pretty common. So true diagnosed nasolacrimal duct obstruction occurs in at least 6% of newborns and is the most common cause of epiphora or persistent tearing and ocular discharge in infants and young children. Patients will usually present with an isolated finding of nasolacrimal duct obstruction, but children with altered facial anatomy, such as those with trisomy 21, CHARGE, craniosynostosis, Goldinghar, your clefting syndromes, hemifacial microsomia, are at an increased risk of congenital nasolacrimal duct obstruction. Additionally, you can have acquired nasolacrimal duct obstruction or a canalicular obstruction with facial trauma, a viral conjunctivitis, or acute dacrocystitis, which we'll talk about more later. I will also say that sometimes premature babies, just because they are smaller in general and haven't fully formed those pathways, can often have epiphora and nasolacrimal duct obstruction as well.
Great, that makes sense. How then will these patients typically present?
So when they present, they will have a history of chronic, constant, or intermittent tearing from the affected eye. Tearing can be worse in situations where there are more tears, such as increased cold or wind. It can also be worse in the setting of an upper respiratory infection when swelling of the nasal mucosa exacerbates that obstruction. Patients usually present shortly after birth within the first few months of life. Obstruction of the nasolacrimal apparatus causes stasis of fluid in the drainage system, and the normal flora within the tears isn't harmful, but stasis can put the baby or the infant or the child at an increased risk of harboring an environment where more pathologic bacteria can develop. That can then lead to dacrocystitis, which patients can also present with or have a history of. Dacrocystitis is essentially a purulent discharge, erythema, or swelling along the medial aspect of the eyelid, and it raises concern for infection, especially in the setting of fever. Early symptoms of infection include poor feeding, mild erythema over the lacrimal sac, and in babies, we actually treat this pretty aggressively with systemic antibiotics and prompt treatment to avoid further complications, including preceptal cellulitis, orbital cellulitis, even meningitis or brain abscess. And definitive treatment following antibiotics is usually surgery, which we'll go into a bit later.
What do you typically see on physical exam for patients with a nasal lacrimal duct obstruction?
You may witness the frequent tearing that patients describe or parents describe. You may see debris on the eyelashes from the buildup and overflow of fluid. You normally won't see erythema of the conjunctiva like you might in other infectious etiologies of frequent tearing. However, there may be some mild redness of the lower and upper eyelid from chronic rubbing of the eyes and irritation. You'll often see an increased size of the tear meniscus, and importantly, palpation of that lacrimal sac on exam may cause reflux of tears or mucoid discharge into the eye through the puncta. This can be unilateral or bilateral. Most don't have a sideness and are equally common in boys and girls. There are no known genetic predispositions to nasolacrimal duct obstruction.
Speaking of other infectious etiologies of frequent tearing, what other conditions should we be thinking about in these infants?
Here is where we want to be careful, because several other serious pathologies can present in infancy with frequent tearing. These include infantile glaucoma, uveitis, or corneal abrasions. All of these will be present with photophobia, which is sometimes hard to diagnose in infants. Conjunctivitis or a foreign body can have conjunctival redness. Ophthalmia neonatorum. This is newborns presenting with purulent eye discharge, and we would assess these babies for gonorrhea, chlamydia, or both. And this is especially true when purulent eye discharge occurs in the first 2 to 3 weeks of life. Other signs of infection may include conjunctival redness and swelling of the eyelids. Also in the differential is an absent puncta or the nasal masses that we've discussed in previous episodes, including nasal glioma. Collaboration with ophthalmology is essential, and we want to be sure that we rule out other diagnoses when indicated.
Once you suspect nasolacrimal duct obstruction, how do you go about officially making a diagnosis?
Diagnosis is actually usually made by history and physical exam, so doing these thoroughly will definitely help you out, and also consulting with our ophthalmology colleagues. If tearing or matting of the eyelashes aren't seen or symptoms are intermittent, the dye disappearance test can also be performed. Basically, this involves placing a drop of anesthetic in each eye, followed by fluorescein. Observe the patient for 5 minutes without wiping away any tears or touching the eyes. And after 5 minutes, looking to see where that fluorescein dye is. So it should drain into the nose if there's no obstruction. This test is normal if most of the fluorescein is gone within 5 minutes, and abnormal if there's still a lot of fluorescein in the eye or it's drained over the lower eyelid and down the cheek.
What is the natural history of nasolacrimal duct obstructions, and how do you go about treating these?
Thankfully, there's actually a very high rate of spontaneous recovery for these patients. Up to 90% of infants will spontaneously resolve this by 12 months old, and mostly before 6 to 10 months of age. Spontaneous resolution may occur sooner in patients with unilateral nasolacrimal duct obstruction compared to bilateral, and for whatever reason, sooner in males compared to females. However, once a diagnosis is made, there are some interventions we can try to do to help these obstructions resolve. Lacrimal sac massage, also called Kriegler massage, is the first-line treatment for nasolacrimal duct obstruction. So external massage of that lacrimal sac is performed medial to the eye, and it can require a fair bit of pressure. Essentially, you're trying to increase the hydrostatic pressure of the nasolacrimal system contents to either rupture the obstructing membrane or push tears and mucus through that stenotic segment. You apply pressure in a downward direction for 2 to 3 seconds at a time, 2 to 3 times a day. It's often recommended to accompany this with a cleansing of the lids with warm water and sometimes topical antibiotics if there's a mucopurulent component to it.
If nasolacrimal duct obstruction doesn't self-resolve, what options are available for further management?
We know that nasolacrimal duct obstructions that persist upon a year of age are unlikely to resolve spontaneously, so these would warrant further intervention. Usually, if symptoms are persisting beyond 6 to 7 months of age, they'll be referred to either us or ophthalmology for consideration of surgical intervention. For persistent obstruction beyond that 6 to 10 months of age, lacrimal duct probing can be performed. Some do advocate for waiting until the patient is about a year old to assure that the obstruction is unlikely to resolve on its own, though probing after 6 months is still acceptable. Some advocate, however, for early probing because depending on the preference of the surgeon and the family, it may be able to be performed in the office with local anesthesia versus OR under general anesthetic at an older age. Early probing also results in earlier symptom resolution, and the risk of lacrimal duct scarring and infection may, in theory, be lower as well. Infection or cellulitis obviously needs to be resolved prior to intervention in the operating room, and multiple occurrences of this would lead me to try to treat earlier. Probing involves applying a topical anesthetic to the eye and then inserting a small rounded probe that looks kind of like a wire into that punctum and advancing it until it comes in contact with the obstruction. Then that probe is gently advanced through the obstruction and into the nose. Usually you can perform some patency via fluorescein stained saline. Generally, this works pretty well, resolving around 75 to 90% of obstructions, though some data shows the success rate of probing actually will decrease with age. Another line of treatment involves nasolacrimal duct intubation. So this is performed under general anesthesia and involves placement of a silicone stent into that nasolacrimal drainage system. This assures patency in the duct and prevents obstruction and contraction that may occur during normal healing. This is performed for patients who fail probing or maybe a first-line option for patients and their first intervention is taking place in the OR. These patients usually are older. Those stents are then left in and then removed in the office 2 to 6 months after placement. Success rates are also very high for this procedure, above 90% if it's performed as a primary treatment, or in the mid-80s for patients that are returning for treatment after a failed prior intervention. Also successful specifically for older patients and for those older than 7 years of age. And this makes sense because we would expect those children to need stenting because whatever was done previous or naturally didn't work for these kids. They're also probably more likely to keep the stents in place. An additional option is balloon dilation of the nasolacrimal duct. In practice, it's very similar to our balloon dilation of the sinuses, though I don't know of any otolaryngologist that do this, and I would refer the patient to an ophthalmologist. And then we'll talk more about dacrocystorhinostomy as another line of treatment when we discuss dacrocystocele, but this is an option for those with a bony obstruction or those who fail what we just discussed.
That's a great transition into our other major topic for discussion for this episode, which is dacrocystocele, also known as a nasolacrimal duct cyst. How is a nasolacrimal duct cyst different from just nasolacrimal duct obstruction?
Similar to nasolacrimal duct obstruction, a nasolacrimal duct cyst or dacrocystocele is caused by obstruction in the nasolacrimal apparatus. However, instead of just obstruction at one level, usually distal at the valve of Hasner, as we mentioned, there is also an obstruction proximally. This proximal obstruction is usually at the valve of Rosenmüller or the common canaliculi. The proximal obstruction is a one-way valve, allowing tears or fluid to enter the nasolacrimal duct, but does not allow retrograde flow of tears. So this results in a buildup in the stasis of fluid, causing distension of the nasolacrimal duct and the lacrimal sac. Typically, this will develop within the first 12 weeks of life.
How then do these patients typically present when they have dacrocystocele?
Patients will usually have a characteristic cystic, fluctuant, kind of bluish or violaceous bulge towards the medial canthus. You may also see superior displacement of that medial canthal tendon. With distension of the nasolacrimal duct and the lacrimal sac, patients will have resultant swelling in the nose and can have nasal obstruction. This can be an issue due to the fact that babies breathe through their nose, especially if you're thinking about bilateral dacrocystoceles. This can result in breathing or feeding difficulties. They're actually cited as the second most common cause of congenital nasal obstruction in infants following choanal atresia. As we mentioned, stasis of fluid in the nasolacrimal apparatus predisposes these patients to infection. Dacrocystitis can occur in up to 75% of these babies, so this may be a factor in their presentation. And dacrocystitis in these patients will manifest similarly as a nasolacrimal duct obstruction and can present with painful, swollen, erythematous skin around the inferior medial canthal area. Complications also similar: precipital cellulitis, orbital cellulitis, meningitis, brain abscess. These kids get admitted to the NICU and started on pretty aggressive IV antibiotics and with careful attention to their airway and feeding. In terms of epidemiology, dacrocystocele is a little more common than 1 in 4,000 births in the U.S. Interestingly, dacrocystocele is reported more commonly in females, Caucasians, and is most often unilateral. They've been detected on ultrasound in utero, but have also been reported to resolve spontaneously by birth in some instances.
How is dacrocystocele typically diagnosed?
Again, usually history and physical exam are enough to make the diagnosis. This includes nasal endoscopy to assess for nasal obstruction due to swelling of the nasolacrimal duct and lacrimal sac. Sometimes these patients receive imaging to further help differentiate this from other nasal masses. CT can be the imaging modality of choice for suspected dacrocystocele, and what we would expect to see on CT would include nasolacrimal duct dilation, a well-defined homogeneous thin-walled mass with fluid attenuation, and this will involve the nasal cavity or the medial canthus. You can also see superior displacement of the bone and the inferior turbinate and the nasal septum being shifted to the contralateral side in very severe cases.
Once this diagnosis has been made, how are these patients treated, and are there any differences from nasolacrimal duct obstruction in terms of their management?
Management is still a bit controversial for dacrocystocele. For these patients, conservative therapies are often thought of as the first line of treatment, including lacrimal sac massage, similar to nasolacrimal duct obstruction. This is advocated for in early and uncomplicated dacrocystocele. Massage may reduce the likelihood of surgical intervention, though this ultimately may be where patients get definitive treatment. Uncomplicated dacrocystoceles are more likely to resolve with conservative therapy, around 85 to 90%, and an associated dacrocystitis most likely warrants some form of surgical intervention, though. We're thinking about the causative organisms here as being alpha-hemolytic strep, staph epidermidis, and staph aureus. So think about your typical skin bugs. Probing is also considered along similar lines as nasolacrimal duct obstruction and has been shown to successfully decompress dacrocystoceles. If probing is performed in the setting of dacrocystitis, pre-op antibiotics should be given. Intranasal extension of the cyst warrants surgical intervention and marsupialization, especially in the setting of nasal obstruction in infants. Decompression for dacrocystitis is more likely to involve dacrocystorhinostomy or DCR than simple nasal lacrimal duct obstruction. And you're essentially creating a drainage pathway into the nose more proximally than the valve of Hasner at the level of the lacrimal sac. This way, you preserve the normal active drainage mechanism for tears, and DCR is typically performed endoscopically. To briefly summarize DCR, you're probing or dilating the nasal lacrimal apparatus from above, but then also using that to identify the area of the lacrimal bone. The mucosa overlying the lacrimal bone in the lateral wall of the nasal cavity is elevated, and then that bone is removed to marsupialize this area, allowing for drainage into the nasal cavity at this level. For both nasolacrimal duct obstruction and dacrocystoceles, the recurrence rate after surgical intervention is low, but it does warrant follow-up with ENT in coordination with our colleagues in ophthalmology or oculoplastics for monitoring.
Great. Another really great and thorough review of common issues for the nasolacrimal duct and when it is obstructed in infants and children. Is there anything else you'd like to mention or make sure that we cover related to this topic?
A few kind of pearls of wisdom just from clinical practice. So for nasolacrimal duct cysts, they can be really difficult to identify in infants. And oftentimes I find that a headlight and a nasal speculum actually can be easier to see these than an endoscope because they are so far in anterior. You really have to be cognizant of examining the inferior to the head of the inferior turbinate. And if the baby's very wiggly or your endoscope is too big, it's easy to get posterior and have not actually evaluated that area. I will often also give some Afrin in the nose to help decompress things, which can make the cyst, a nasolacrimal duct cyst, more obvious. And then as far as using surgical instruments, the otoendoscope tray is really nice because it's small, and I use the same operative instruments from that set. So the alligators and the scissors, and then a tiny, tiny microdebrider to really fully marsupialize these. And then we'll often work with our ophthalmology colleagues to keep the child on some nasal hygiene and eye drops to keep that area patent while they heal.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Meister. In summary, nasolacrimal duct obstruction occurs in at least 6% of newborns, making it a relatively common condition. The most common site of obstruction is at Hasner's valve, manifesting as an imperforate membrane inhibiting drainage of the nasolacrimal duct. The second most common cause of obstruction is nasolacrimal duct stenosis. Nasolacrimal duct cyst, or dacrocystoceles, involves two levels of obstruction, at the valve of Hasner and at the valve of Rosenmüller, or common canaliculi. At the proximal site of obstruction, there is a one-way valve, causing accumulation of fluid and development of a cystic fluid collection. Infants will present with constant tearing from the eye in nasolacrimal duct obstruction, or cystic bluish swelling inframedial to the medial canthus in dacrocystoceles. Both of these are typically diagnosed clinically with history and physical exam. While conservative measures such as lacrimal sac massage can assist in spontaneous resolution of nasolacrimal duct obstruction, surgical options include probing, duct intubation or dilation, or dacrocystorhinostomy, or DCR. For dacrocystoceles, nasal obstruction from the cystic swelling can interfere with breathing, warranting surgical intervention by endoscopic marsupialization of the intranasal sac. Dacrocystitis can occur in up to 75% of dacrocystoceles cases and can include fever, erythema, purulent discharge, and swelling on the medial aspect of the eyelid, if not treated. The high risk of infection in dacrocystoceles makes a case for early surgical intervention in these patients. Surgical intervention in the setting of dacrocystitis is more likely to involve DCR than simple nasolacrimal sac decompression. Next, on to our questions. First, What are the two most common sites of nasolacrimal duct obstruction? Nasolacrimal duct obstruction occurs when all but one site of the nasolacrimal apparatus is canalized. The most common site of nasolacrimal duct obstruction is at Hasner's valve. An imperforate membrane prevents drainage of lacrimal fluid into the nasal cavity at this level. General stenosis of the duct is the second most common cause of duct obstruction. Next question. What physiologically differentiates decrocystocele from nasolacrimal duct stenosis? In decrocystocele, there are two levels of obstruction. First, the valve of Hasner, and second, either the valve of Rosenmüller or common canaliculi. At the proximal site of obstruction, there is a one-way valve that causes accumulation of fluid and the subsequent development of the cystic fluid collection. For nasolacrimal duct obstruction that doesn't self-resolve, or for complicated decrocystocele, what is the ladder of surgical intervention? For persistent nasolacrimal duct obstruction beyond 6 to 10 months that has not responded to conservative measures such as lacrimal massage, lacrimal duct probing can be performed. This procedure is usually really successful and can resolve around 75 to 90% of obstructions. The next step, nasolacrimal duct intubation, or potentially balloon dilation of the nasolacrimal duct, can be considered as a primary or a secondary intervention. And finally, decrocystorhinostomy or DCR can be performed for those with bony obstruction or who have failed these other interventions or upfront for more complex instances of decrocystocele. All right, that's it for now. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time on HeadMirror's ENT in a Nutshell.